بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome once again to a new session, our third session of this course from Ali to Al-Mahdi, a course on Imama, Imam Mahdi and Ghaiba. So in the last two sessions we've been discussing some foundation discussions on how to approach on the tools that we will use when we're studying Imama. So how to approach the whole discussion of Imama from its different tools. And we, Sheikh Kadhim, in the last two sessions, expanded on the topic by saying that we have two major tools, the aql, the intellect, and the transmitted sources. Amongst transmitted sources were the Quran, the ahadith, and authentic history. So in the first session, we talked about the aql and a part of the Quran we discussed. And in the second session, we expanded more on the Quran and looked at it from different perspectives. So inshallah, in this session, we'll now go on to discussing the ahadith and looking a little bit more about ahadith and seeing how, if we can use ahadith in the first place, and if we were to use them, how do we go about using them? Especially with the fact that we'll be using a hadith in later sessions when exploring Imama. So, Sheikh Kadhim, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much.
Assalamu, thank you very much for coming. So, let's get cracking. So, today, inshallah, we'll be talking about hadith.
Okay, so today's discussion is very, very important. Probably, I would say that if I compare its importance with the last two sessions, Probably I would put it at the top of the list in terms of the importance it has for this course which we are doing.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. The first being that a good number of details of Imama that we're going to talk about are going to come from hadith.
Yeah.
So this idea I have been mentioning, that intellect brings us to some answers to some of the questions. And as we mentioned, intellect has its own limits. So it's going to take us one step closer to understanding Imama. And we'll come to that part, that how much intellect can help us.
Yeah.
Then you go to the second source or tool for answering questions related to Imama. And we spoke about the Holy Quran being the source. And we haven't, our discussion was not to actually study Imama in the Quran.
In the Quran, yeah.
And definitely that's the thing that's going to soon come.
So that's the next session.
So that would be really interesting. We're just laying some foundations that, look, when Quran is used to answer any question, and for example, this specific question about Imama, these are some certain things that have to be kept in mind. So that was the second source. But we have this third source and tool that is very central to understanding of Imama for a variety of reasons. So I'll maybe even allude to some of them. And then when there'll be a discussion in this course about Imama from the perspective of ahadith, there it will be discussed more. That details that we have regarding the Imama are going to come from the ahadith. So a very clear example is that identifying, for example, who's the fifth Imam, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that fifth Imam, there's a long gap between the time when the Quran was revealed and his time. It's the time of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. So identifying who's the fifth Imam, the person of the fifth Imam, is going to be heavily tied to our understanding of ahadith, the nas that we would have from the fourth Imam, trying to tell us who's going to be the next Imam, and also history, authentic history will come into picture there.
Yeah.
So this is an important tool that we need to discuss. So that's one reason that we are talking about this, and we'll go into some of the details that are there. The second reason that I'm saying that this is really important is that because there are questions and doubts being raised today about authenticity of ahadith and how can we use them, and which of these ahadiths are reliable and which are not reliable, and how does this process work? So basically,
I mean, there are different schools of thought about how to even deal with the hadith. Even
exactly.
Among scholars, there's differences. So we need to, we want to have a general understanding of how hadith even works. Like, what's
exactly.
the, you know, how do you deal with
so
it?
So again, I say this to my audience, that we are not entering the discussion on Imama yet. We are looking at the processes that go behind dealing with such issues. So it gives you an insider's view of how the scholars deal with hadith, although it's a very very brief. I mean, so when I was preparing for this, I was saying that, oh, wow, there's so much
so here, much written yeah.
here, and we just have one session. So we'll have to like squeeze the information that we have and just give you that those main important parts. So we'll try our best to discuss this matter. Yeah. Yes.
So we're still laying the foundations. We're still talking about we're still talking about these tools. Tools that are specific for Imamah. We're going one step behind, and we're trying to analyze the tools that we would use normally for any topic regarding Islam.
Exactly.
And then once we've understood this, then we're going to focus on use this on Imamah in a later session. But I think you're going to give examples as well during this session that will help us relate to it as well.
So I'll try and give examples so that the audience have at least some understanding that, okay, this is how this may be used with respect to the topic of Imam. So I'll begin by saying this, that one of the beautiful things that we have in our madhab, the madhab of Ahlul Bayt, is that everything is put in a logical sequence. So we're talking about this idea that you start with your intellect. Intellect leads you to the Holy Quran. And then Holy Quran is a huge and very important source of knowledge. It's a new world in terms of the information. It gives the realities it uncovers for us.
Yeah.
Now, what happens is that Quran, in addition to talking to us about different realities that are there, it also opens another source for us. So it's like it's linked. Intellect takes us to the Quran. And now Quran leads us to this idea of having this person, the Holy Prophet of Islam, and saying that his words and what he says other than the revealed Quran. So even the Holy Quran that we have was revealed through the Holy Prophet.
Yeah.
So although we know, and this is an established fact, that these words that are there in the Quran, these are not the words of the Prophet.
The words were revealed by Allah. Yeah.
So yes, he's the medium through which these words are being delivered to people. But in addition to having Quran as the source of knowledge and source of Islam, and when we say source of Islam, it's actually a source of knowing reality. So there's no difference between these two. So Islam is real, and one of the important realities out there is what Islam tells us. So these are one and the same thing. So although we don't need to go into the details of this discussion, why? Because all Islamic sects accept at least the Holy Prophet to be a source of Islam, his words and whatever he says to be a source of Islam. So there's a consensus amongst Muslims that after Quran, we have another source, and that's what the Prophet would tell people, explain people, talk about the different details of religion. So if we really wouldn't have the need to go into the discussion, because everyone accepts it.
That's true. The question, though, would be that what the Prophet tells us outside of the Quran, firstly, is it something that is necessary for us to know and to adopt? Or the necessary stuff was said in the Quran. These are extra explanations for those who don't really understand what happened in the Quran. They need a bit of explanation and expounding on the meaning. But the necessary stuff is not with the Prophet. What the Prophet says is not necessary for us to know. It's good if we know it's beneficial. But for, let's say, our akhirat and the basic we need to know for salvation, it's all there in the Quran, and that's it.
Okay.
So I know the term Hasbuna Kitabullah has its own connotations, but why not?
Yeah. So that's an important question that we will try and answer here. And we would say that definitely Quran gives us a major good part of our guidance. It lays the foundations and tells us those very fundamental and foundational things that we need for our guidance. But we know for a fact that there are many things in the Quran, there are many things which are not mentioned in the Quran. And we know for a fact historically that the Holy Prophet came and he explained and mentioned those things. And when he mentioned those things, he would say that, for example, there's no mention of how exactly a prayer is supposed to be, other than just the mention of it having a ruku and, for example, sujood. But this exact format of how you pray was something that was given to the people as a something that's binding from the Holy Prophet. So we know historically that the Holy Prophet would come and would give the details of Ahkam, for example.
And the Quran hasn't mentioned them, so the Quran assumes that you're going to get the rest of the information from the Prophet. I'm going to give you this amount that Salah is wajib, and then you go in front to the Prophet and get it.
And to do that, Quran has many, many verses that point to this idea that Quran is source of guidance, but even the words of Holy Prophet are also source of guidance. So what I'll try and do very, very briefly here is use the same principles I was talking about yesterday. Okay. So we said that Quran, you can't just look at one verse and prove or disprove something. So for example, you look at one verse and said, oh, this verse didn't mention a certain thing, therefore it doesn't exist. No. Mm-hmm. So we'll put together different verses of the Quran. Of course, we don't want to lengthen this part too much. So the idea or the way to approach this is that those people have worked on this discussion, they have classified and put together different sets of verses together. And when you look at these 2-3 sets of verses, I'm going to point to these, when you put all of these together, you reach this conclusion that words of the Holy Prophet, the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet, the Ahadith of the Holy Prophet are binding, and they themselves are a source of law and also reality. So basically, this is also an important point to note, right? That things that we have in the Holy Quran, for example, are of two types. A part of it is explaining the reality. But a good part of it are the commands, is the law, is the do's and don'ts that we are supposed to follow. The same thing holds true for the words of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So at times he would come and give out those do's and don'ts. Pray like this, don't pray like this. This is halal, this is haram. Things which are not mentioned in the Quran. And it's not just one or two or few things that he would say, this is halal, this is haram. There are like hundreds of things that are not in the Quran, and he would come and he would explain and mention the law. But also he would explain the realities as well. So there's something not mentioned in the Quran, he would come and he would say that, look, this is a reality. Okay, and let me just connect it to the discussion about Imamah. So sometimes people have this question, and it will be answered in the discussion about Imamah from the Quran, that, oh, why is name of Amirul Mumineen not mentioned in the Quran? So it's an important question. Do make sure that when you have the session, you ask it. I'm sure you have these questions with you. But for whatever reason, name of Amirul Mumineen is not in the Quran. But it's very, very clearly there in the words of the Holy Prophet. Okay. So if I accept words of Holy Prophet to be something that uncovers reality for me, and the Holy Prophet comes and says that Man kuntu mawla fa aliyun mawla, for example. He's telling us something really important. And following that becomes binding on us. So you see that there's like a strong link between words of the Holy Prophet and the idea of Imamah and Amirul Mumineen being the first Imam. Yeah.
So basically,
the nas of Imamah, that the first Imam is the person of Ali ibn Abi Talib, is going to come from the Sunnah of the Prophet. Mm. This is how Allah has put it out. Yeah. And there's no problem in doing that if we establish that the words of the Holy Prophet are actually the words of God. He's delivering what Allah has told him.
Yeah. So basically the system works like this, where the Quran is basically coming with the guidance, but it's saying, look, I'm not bringing all the details because, and I am referring you to another source outside of myself.
Exactly.
And that other source is going to complement me and give you the information that I have not brought, the details of which I have not brought here. So the details that the Prophet gives us are as binding as the details the Quran gives us.
Exactly. So in terms of their binding nature, there's no difference. But how do these two interact with each other, Quran and Hadith? That's an important discussion, and we should talk about that. Yeah. But that's a separate thing. Yeah. But
are we going to talk about that?
So what we'll try and do is that we'll first try to get some basics of Hadith put in place. So we know that when you're talking about Hadith, their authenticity, and how do we approach it in a general sense. When that's done, then we'll be in a better position to talk that, okay, now Hadith is this, These are the authentic ahadith. These are the ones that you can rely on. But you also have the Quran. How do these two interact with each other? Okay. What's the
so
exact
I won't precise? Question you on this right
yeah.
now.
So if you want to make it systematic, this would be a better approach. We finish this one discussion. So let me come back to what we're discussing. So there are a number of verses in the Holy Quran that tell us that prophets are explainer of the wahi sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So let me read one of those verses. So this is Surah Ibrahim, verse number 4. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ رَسُولٍ إِلَّا بِاللِّسَانِ قَوْمِهِ We did not send any apostle except that he would speak the language of his people, right? Because he's there for guiding them. So he needs to be speaking to them in their own language. So Rasulullah would speak to people in Arabic. Why? It says, لِيُبَيِّنَ لَهُمْ So this says that he might explain our message to them. Okay, so then it says, فَيُذِلُّ اللَّهُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيَهْدِي مَنْ يَشَاءُ So what the Mufassirin have said here is that this sentence that's coming, فَيُذِلُّ اللَّهُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيَهْدِي shows that that explanation which was given by the Prophet completes the hujjah on the people. That if someone accepts the guidance, it's for his benefit. If he rejects this explanation given by that prophet, then he's entering into misguidance. So they've used this connection between these two verses. So this is how they used and to make the meaning of the Quran. So they said that the words and the explanations given by the prophets are binding. Why? Because when this explanation comes, the path of guidance and misguidance becomes clear. Yeah. So this is a nice way of putting it together and saying it. So this is one set of verses. I'm not going to go through all of them. For example, there's another verse in the Surah An-Nahl, verse number 44, that talks about this same idea for the Holy Prophet of Islam. Okay, so I think even, let me just quickly read that
for you. Yeah,
if
you can just quickly read it.
So this is regarding the Holy Prophet. So it has this word لِتُبَيِّنَ
وَأَنزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ مَا نُزِلَ إِلَيْهِمْ
Exactly. So this is the verse. So it says وَأَنزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ And we have revealed unto you this الذِّكْر which is the Quran لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ مَا نُزِلَ إِلَيْهِمْ So this Quran has been revealed. The apparent meaning of the Quran is clear. But yet there are details that need to be added and explained. And these details are binding. These details are something which people have to follow. It's part of guidance. It tells me what's haq and batil and what I have to follow. Yeah. Okay. Although this is one set of verses. There's another set of verses that talks about a kind of unconditional obedience to the Holy Prophet. So, I mean, the number of verses that talk about obeying the Prophet are so many, right? Atiu Allahu Atiu Rasul. So this is regarding the Holy Prophet of Islam. Regarding all the Rusul. وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ رَسُولٍ إِلَّا لِيُطَاءَ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ We have not sent any apostle, any Rasul, except that he should be obeyed. Of course, he's not to be obeyed independent of Allah. حَتَّى لِيُذَا بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ Allah is saying it. He should be obeyed. So here, what Allama Tabatabai says, he says that this obedience to the Holy Prophet of Islam in our context is actually in two areas. So let me even read this part because one of the things we said yesterday was to refer to experts when we want to understand the Quran, right? So
yeah.
I'm not going to explain right now that how did he reach this conclusion? He mentioned it in Tafsir al-Mizan. But what I'm trying to do is that, look, there is this verse. It says that prophets have to be obeyed. Question, in what matters? It's a question, right? Allama Tabatabai answers. So he says that, إِحْدَاهُمَا, the first place where we need to obey the prophets is, حَيْثِيَّةُ التَّشْرِي بِمَا يُوهِيهِ إِلَيْهِ رَبِّهِ مِنْ غَيْرِ كِتَابٍ So he's saying that one of the aspects that we need to obey the Prophet is that aspect of the Prophet being the lawgiver. So if Prophet comes and explains a law which is not there in the Quran, he has been given that authority, we are supposed to obey him. So this is when Allah says, أَتِيُ اللَّهَ وَأَتِيُ الرَّسُولِ One of the aspects of obedience is when he tells you that pray namaz like this, We should obey. And obedience means it's binding for us. So this is important, that the sunnah of the Prophet, of course, you have to accurately understand it.
And what's interesting here, a person can't come and say, oh Prophet, show me where in the Quran says to pray like this. I am the one who is completing the Quran. Exactly. So you can't say, show me where in the Quran it says it like this, basically.
So exactly. Yeah. So in one sense, and you're mentioning it that as well, that Sunnah and the Hadith of the Holy Prophet is at par with the Quran in one sense.
In the binding,
it derives its being a source, being authentic from the Quran.
Yeah, its value and its validity comes from the Quran. Yeah.
But once it's valid, the content it gives you is as binding as the Holy Quran. So that's important. And I think you mentioned this thing that even asking this, that where is this mentioned in the Quran, wouldn't be a valid question. Because Quran is saying that, look, I have given you this amount of guidance. Now you go beyond me and ask the Holy Prophet for more guidance, for the details of the guidance. Of course, but this is also true that it's not unrelated to the Quran.
Yeah.
Of course, foundations are laid.
So there is an indication to it being there. That the Quran says that there's something regarding, let's say, there's something, the concept of Salah.
Exactly.
I'm not going to give you details about it. Get the details from the Prophet.
Exactly.
And don't ask, you know, where are the details in the Quran? That's not the plan.
That's not the plan.
Right? Why did Allah choose to put details of certain things in the Quran and the details of others to keep it only with the Prophet? No, in the Quran, that's Allah's wisdom, I guess.
That's Allah's wisdom. And we have been given some insight on that as well, that why this was arranged. Probably, I don't know if the later teachers would probably talk about it. So, I mean, when it's happened like this, we know there must be some wisdom, right?
So and then we just go and think about the fact what might be the wisdom.
We have allusions, for example, that Quran had to be one single book. It couldn't have so much detail.
Yeah.
It could have been a reason. The other reason could have been, and this has been mentioned, that maybe Allah wanted people to go and refer to the Prophet. Why? Because he's also a role model. So to make that position of Prophet prominent and important, he was also made a source. Maybe that's the reason.
Yeah.
Maybe so that attachment and connection all the Muslims have with the person of the Holy Prophet. Maybe that was intended, that people refer to him, go to him. Maybe that's part of the wisdom.
Mm.
And you can still even imagine very many other reasons that.
So what we know is that there is definitely a wisdom behind it.
Yeah.
The fact that this is happening, that Allah is asking us to refer to a source other than the Quran, and that being the Prophet, for now we've established the Prophet, that has its own wisdom. Why? Well, we can come up with different reasons why.
So even these points I mentioned, I'm not saying this definitely is the wisdom. I'm just like trying to come up with some educated guess. Yes, if I find a reference to that in authentic sources, for example, if I find a hadith that actually says that, look, this was the wisdom, yeah, I'll rely. But I can just think about it a bit and give different possibilities. So these are the possibilities. I'm not conclusively saying that this definitely was the wisdom. I'm saying this could have been the wisdom, and this is sufficient wisdom for Allah to work out this arrangement. And we know for a fact that this is the arrangement that Allah has done. Part of it is Quran. Quran leads you to the hadith, and the details are there. So what's interesting here, I brought this part from Tafsir al-Mizan. So he says that one place where we need to obey Allah is tashri'. He's giving out the law. It's binding. Now, what he does is, وَيَرْتَبِتُ بِهَا كَمَا قَالَ تَعَالَى وَأَنْزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ مَا نُزِّلَ إِلَيْهِمْ. The verse I previously mentioned, he refers to that here. So he's connecting the idea of ita'at to the first set of verses. So see, the same thing is happening. So you have one set of verses that tell us that Holy Prophet is the explainer of the Quran. There's another set of verses that tell us that his obedience is necessary. Allah Ta'ala is putting these two together, saying that, look, this ita'a includes his explanation. So this is the beauty of Tafsir al-Mizan. He can connect these verses and put them in their right place.
Yeah.
Of course, I'll just point to the second part. He says, وَثَانِيَ مَا يَرَاهُ مِنْ سَوَابِ الرَّأِ وَهُوَ الَّذِي يَرْتَبِتُ بِوِلَايَتِهِ الْحُكُومَ. So the other part where obedience to the Holy Prophet is necessary is in the matters of governance. So in addition to being a source of law and source of Islam, the Holy Prophet also held the political position. He is the political, divine political leader of all the Muslims. And in that sense, his obedience also is obligatory. So these two aspects of obedience, Allama Tawatawai mentions, and then he cites another verse to prove this second part. لِتَحْكُمَ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ بِمَا أَرَاكَ اللَّهِ So this is Surah An-Nisa, verse number 5. It's very clear that you are supposed to judge between people, do hukm between people, بِمَا أَرَاكَ اللَّهِ Of course, he's not doing to randomly judge between people. He'll have divine criteria to rule. So that's the divine leadership of the Holy Prophet that we have and that we had seen in history. So
yeah.
I think we'll not go into more detail. Yeah. So there's a third set of verses, for example, people have used saying that this idea that Holy Prophet is a role model. So this takes us to a new dimension, which tells us that his actions are also binding. Hmm. So I'm slowly.
What do you mean by actions being binding on us?
So here we come to this idea that when we say the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet, we actually mean three things. One is the words of the Holy Prophet are binding, their source of law, their source of reality. So that's the hadith that he's been speaking. These are the words. But in addition to that, there's a second thing which is part of Sunnah is his actions are binding. What does it mean is that the least, I'm saying, the least that it means is that if Holy Prophet performs an action, definitely it's not haram.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, definitely because he's the role model. And the other qualities of the Prophet that he's ma'asum and other things that will be discussed later. So when he does something, that also tells us a reality.
Yeah.
So if you are in doubt, for example, that eating this certain thing is permissible or not, and if you can conclusively establish that in history, the Holy Prophet he ate this thing, the least you can say is that it's not haram.
Mm-hmm.
So actions of the Holy Prophet are also a source. Of course, to what extent is something that's again discussed in that usulul fiqh. So it comes in picture.
So how can we tell if this is more than mubah or not, more than allowed or not, right?
Yeah. So, for example, there's an interesting example they give. Let's say the Holy Prophet comes and says that, okay, my companions, I'm teaching you how to pray. Okay. He's not explaining with words. He stands there and he prays. So now, because he is right now in the position of teaching an obligatory action in Islam, whatever the Holy Prophet does becomes part of Salat. So mm-hmm. you can understand that. And it's what's interesting is we have narrations describing how the Holy Prophet used to pray.
Yeah.
So they would say that he did this first, then he did that, and then he performed the sequence of actions.
I would guess,
they use that in giving fatwa.
Yeah, so and then I would guess if throughout the life of the Prophet we find that there might be certain actions he does in Salah that he does sometimes and doesn't do other times, we know from that that those were not wajib, they were mustahab. So putting all these together, we can come to the form of the Salah, so again, which part of it is definitely part of Salah, which one is mustahab.
We'll also use the other ahadith. So the bottom line is that even the actions of the Prophet are part of his sunnah. It's the source for us. There's a third thing which, again, because we just also wanted to give the technical definition of sunnah. So they say that sunnah is the fa'il, is the qawl, fa'il and taqreer of the ma'asum. So in our case, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So his words are part of the sunnah and
his actions,
they're binding. Yeah. His action, there's a third thing, and that is that when something is being done in his presence and he approves of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so approval is...
What do you mean by approval? Okay. Yeah.
So, for example, one of the ways to approve is to not show anything, do not show a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for example, someone is praying in front of him in a certain manner and he's watching it, he's paying attention and it's happening in front of him. And he doesn't show any reaction. It doesn't stop him. He says that, why are you praying like this? Oh, this was wrong. If he doesn't do that, we take his silence as an approval.
But this, I guess, this is based on another premise, which is that it is the duty of the Prophet to speak when he sees something wrong.
Exactly. So all this has been worked out in detail. Yeah. So they have said that, why is it his duty? So some have come and said that, look, he's the Prophet. it's obligatory upon him to do Amr bil Maruf and Nahi
That's what he's come for.
Then there's also, he's come to explain the guidance. And now the guidance is not happening in front of him.
But then there's also the idea that maybe it's his duty, but there is a something preventing him. For example, let's say, for example, somebody is praying. Let's say I'm out of the blue. Somebody is praying really badly, but let's say, for example, the Prophet knows that if he tells him, this guy is going to react really badly and cause chaos.
Okay, exactly.
And it's not worth it here. And people know this; they are aware of this. For example,
but you'll have to establish
that. You'll have to establish
that. So, for example, you have to establish
the fact that there is a barrier that stops the Prophet from doing
this. So again, we are not here to discuss all these details and technicalities. We're just trying to say that look, his silence can have meaning.
Yeah.
We can understand things from it. How we can understand it, and what's the process? Definitely, there's another place.
So each and every situation will need to be analyzed in itself, and look at the different factors around that. Because every silence of the Prophet will not necessarily mean the same thing. Because really, context makes a big difference.
Yeah. So one example that also will come later, I guess, and sometimes in the discussion is this. Although it's a topic that needs a separate and solid discussion, is the idea of taqiyya. For example, he wants to show his disapproval, but the situation is such that taqiyya necessitates that he doesn't show any reaction.
For example, Imam Sajjad, who didn't rise against the Bani Umayyah at that time, is not a sign of his approval.
Exactly. Right? So this is a very good example that the situation did not allow him to express his disapproval. So his silence doesn't mean his approval. Anything, So and it's a very interesting way of how they make the link and what are the things that go behind it. So basically it's even kind of like you enter into a bit of intellectual argument here that you're trying to put different pieces together, trying to actually understand that when Imam was silent, what was happening inside him?
Yeah.
Was he approving that he was silent or no? He was disapproving of that thing, but the things that led him to not show any reaction. Anyway, so we don't want to go into the details of it. So the bottom line is that we have this thing called Hadith, or the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet. And of course, we know that a major portion of the Sunnah are the words. It's the Hadith. These are the things that have been narrated from Rasulullah. So you have Kala Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, means he said something. So this is something that we need to talk about. So what I'm going to do is that when we're talking about Hadith, there are two important things that in terms of the method of benefiting from Hadith that we need to take into consideration. One is that the meaning of the Hadith. So Hadith is a sentence, right? It's a sentence in Arabic. So how do we understand it? We don't need to go into the details because it's the principles are the same which you mentioned for the Holy Quran.
Yeah.
So in terms of Quran being a text and Hadith being a text in Arabic, there's no difference. So all those things we said would apply. You need to know Arabic. You need to know principles of jurisprudence, those general laws of understanding text. You need to look at all the Hadiths together. You can't pick out one Hadith and derive a conclusion. All those principles that we mentioned, you need to look at the historical context of that Hadith if it has any involvement in understanding. So all those tools would come when it comes to understanding the meaning of Hadith. So we won't repeat that discussion, but you can go through many, many examples of this, that sometimes how we can have a wrong understanding of something if we just like look at one Hadith on a topic and then say that, this is the conclusion. You have one Hadith, there can be other Ahadith that limit the scope of that Hadith.
Generally, I think it's really important, and I've seen this myself in many discussions I've had with brothers and sisters, even from different sects, actually, I've seen it, where the brothers and sisters usually fail to consider the different factors that affect a particular hadith or a historical event. So, for example, let's say, why did Imam Hassan not continue fighting? Why did Imam Hussein continue fighting? You know, Why is there a contradiction? Well, there's no contradiction here. He was in a context that did not allow him to do that. And the imam is there to decipher, is this the right time to fight or not? Exactly. Now, we may think, but that was the right time to fight. But by looking at the actions of the imam, we come to realize that, no, if imam decided it's not the time to fight, that means that's the right thing to do. Now, we can think about, speculate why it would have been, right? But this putting the factors together, looking at the context, looking at the different factors and the verses and the hadith, putting all this together is really important to understand one thing. Yeah, we can't just pick one part of the story and then come to conclusions and then, you know, take it all the way forward.
Exactly. Like, for example, take it out from the context, from that setting,
yeah.
And try to say that, okay, this doesn't make any sense. No, if you put it back in that setting, it makes perfect sense. For example, you want to analyze actions of the imams.
Yeah.
It's an interesting part, like their political conduct, for example.
How Imam Ali behaved in his time before his khilafah, during his khilafah, and how Imam Hassan behaved and how Imam Hussein behaved. And then after Imam Hussein, this very different behavior. But then all of it has its own wisdom.
Yeah, and what we say here is that the conduct of the imams was a principled conduct, but they had to take into consideration many, many principles and how these different principles would interact with each other for that particular situation.
It expressed itself
Very different.
The manifestation of it in the outer actions differs,
and
basically.
That's what you say, said, look, it's life, it's complex. Especially if you go into social matters, there's so many factors and considerations. So this is an important point that we need to slowly start appreciating the complexity of the setting in which the imams were placed. And one of the important roles was a very social role of guiding the people, the guiding the Muslims, guiding
and
the
ummah. Sensitive.
It's such a sensitive role. So there's so much happening. So we need to keep so that holistic understanding when it comes to hadith, the words of the imams, and also their conduct and their actions is a really important thing. So,
okay, Sheikh Kazim, we'll take a quick break right now, and then we'll continue the discussion. So, brothers and sisters, if you want to take a quick break, get some tea, water, inshallah, this is the time. We'll be back in a few minutes, inshallah.
إنني ألبي من زينب هتافي كربلاء دربي ومأتمي طوافي بالحسين أرسو في أطهر المرافي قد بنيت قلبي من ذهب العفافي إنها الحورة يوم عاشورا سالت في نبضاتي خيمة المأتم أدمعي زمزم تجري بالندبات موكب نوري والمأتم سوري في نبض الشعور كربلا حياتي في كل فتاتي نادت بالثبات لبيك يا حسين
لبيك يا حسين عني زينبية روحي حسينية قدوتي سكينة وفاطمة ورقية قدوتي سكينة وفاطمة ورقية
الحسين ديني وكربلا هوية وهي في حجابي تجعلني قوية تكمل المعالي تنتصر القضية بالدم الحسيني والمرأة الزينبية كربلا عيني في مياديني نادت عشت يوم العاشر
حسن حسن
واشتياقاتي للزيارات تجري سيلا هادئ
حسن حسن
ومن إبائي نخلا كربلائي في كل النساء صدري كل عاشر يجري بالحرائر قد هز الضمائر بالطفوف أنمو من ألق الطفولة وهوى سكينة يملأني بطولة وأسار قيا والطفلة العليلة في عميق روحي قد غرس العقيلة طفلة أكبر خيمة المنبر حزني في حسينية في الحسينية بالعشر عنواني
حسين
أمي علمتني وعيا ألهمتني أدعو عند حزني ربتني أبي أبقى زينبية من دمع رقيا
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم once again brothers and sisters welcome back after this short break so we're with Sheikh Kazim discussing ahadith as a source of Islamic knowledge and we said that it is the Quran that refers us to a source outside of itself which is the Holy Prophet of Islam and the Quran itself tells us that we should be obeying the Prophet we should actually use it as a source for knowledge and things that the Quran hasn't told us and yet there are things we need to know and they are part and parcel of this whole journey and our success in the Akhirah, then those kind of information, there are certain things that we need to get from the Prophet himself and they're not there in the Quran. So then they're not things that show me where is it in the Quran. The Quran just has a very small allusion towards it and generally it says a lot of these things, it pushes it to the Prophet that you Prophet go and explain these things to the people. And we said that the sunnah of the Prophet is his words, his actions, and his silence. And we had finished talking about what it means, his approval, and how factors and context make have an effect on it.
So one of the important aspects of understanding hadith is understanding the meaning. And we said that the same principles that we use for understanding the Quran, some of which we discussed in the last session, would apply to the hadith because it's a text. And we need to understand the text. And not only we need to understand hadith, keeping in mind other ahadith, but also keeping in mind other verses of the Holy Quran. Because then now you have this whole set of sentences, some from the Quran, some from the hadith, and you want to understand them together. So let me just give a relevant example to the discussion on imamah. So one of the questions, although it's one of the specific questions about imamah, is that do imams have ilmul ghaib or not? So let's say we've established the idea, you have these personalities called imams. So
regarding the characteristics and attributes
of the imams. So the imam is one of the attributes that's discussed is, do they have ilmul ghaib or not? So now we'll have to put all our tools together to answer this question. So one part would be we ask intellect. Can intellect give us some insight on this or not? That's one question. We'll go to the Holy Quran and we'll look at the idea of ilmul ghaib. How does it function there? And does it, can it somehow relate to the idea of imamat or not? So, But an important and a very clear source for answering this question would be the hadith. So, for example, we have a hadith that talk about this idea that imams, for example, have ilmul ghaib. So let me just read as an example this narration we have in Usul al-Kafi. It says, "Inna al-imama idha sha'a an ya'lam ullim." So it says that imam, if he wants to know something, he's taught that.
Okay.
So he has to will and he's given that,
knowledge.
So now this would be an interesting thing to do, that this has a certain meaning. On the other side, we have the verse in the Quran that says, "Qul la ya'lamu man fis samawati wal ardi al ghaiba illa Allah." That no one in the heavens and the earth knows ghaib illa Allah.
Other than Allah. So this hadith is in the apparent contradiction with this.
On one side, it's saying that no one except Allah understand has access to ghaib, ilmul ghaib. But this narration is saying that imam, if he wants, he has access. So, we'll have to somehow, not somehow, we'll have to put these together to get to an accurate understanding.
Although you're assuming authenticity here.
Is an aspect we'll have to talk about.
Yeah, but when you're mentioning this, so recently I was actually looking into this discussion. I have the verses over here regarding it. So in this bahth of the discussion of ilmul ghaib, so Allah brings this verse in the Quran that nobody knows the ghaib other than him. But then the Quran is, so you mentioned a hadith that has this apparent contradiction, but the Quran itself seems to have other verses that show that, you know how you mentioned in the previous session that sometimes Allah gives a general principle, but then he comes and
restricts
its scope, right? Or he says there may be exceptions to this general rule. So if I found this verse, which was interesting, where Allah says, it's a verse, Surah Jinn, verse 26. Yeah. عَلِمُ الْغَيْبِ فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَى غَيْبِ أَحَدًا. The knower of the unseen, so he does not reveal his secrets to any. He does not reveal the ghaib to any. إِلَّا مَنْ ارْتَضَى مِنْ رَسُولٍ. Except to him whom he chooses as an apostle. So Allah is saying that the ilmul ghaib that Allah has and that he doesn't reveal to anybody and only he has, but there are some people he does reveal to, and those people are his prophets.
And so, that would be an interesting hint to pursue, that when you can have certain people who can have access to ghaib, of course, bi-idhnillah and with all the baggage that is going to come, then it might even help us to reconcile this hadith with this whole idea of ilmul ghaib in the Quran. Yeah.
So there's many occasions like this where Allah gives a general principle, but then himself somewhere else in the Quran gives an exception, showing that that general principle was not exclusive and it wasn't 100% general. It wasn't universal. It was a general principle that has exceptions. And often when it comes to these kind of discussions, a lot of times, you know, you can find out that the Prophet was an exception here and things like that.
So this is a very important thing, that understanding hadith, the meaning, looking at the Quran, looking at different verses of the Quran and then the hadith, and putting this all together, is, as we discuss, it has certain principles and method that needs to be used to arrive at accurate understanding. But the discussion that concerns us more today in our discussion is regarding the authenticity of hadith. So that's a key point here, because I think you got the point. So when I brought this hadith and I was trying to bounce it off the Quran and try to understand, the first thing that you came to your mind, and you said that you're assuming it to be authentic.
Yeah. On what basis are you even considering this statement and then trying to reconcile it with the Quran?
And you're right, because if you look in a very technical sense, there's a big difference between how the Quran was transmitted from one generation to another and how the ahadith were transmitted. So when it comes to the Holy Quran, we rarely, except in very academic circles, have a discussion about the transmission of the Quran, because it's known.
It's a given
thing. It's a historically recorded fact that Muslims gave so much importance to the Quran. Hundreds and even thousands of people memorized it. There are things written down. They were checked properly that these are the things. that we know that this book that we have, the Mus'haf that we have today, is exactly what was revealed to the Holy Prophet. So that connection can be made. So authenticity in terms of its transmission, so they call it in terms of its sudur, is definite for the Quran. So we wouldn't go into the discussion. Of course, as an academic pursuit, you can go into the discussion, and you have, for example, a subject in Hawza Ulum al-Quran that will talk about some of the aspects. But we know this, and it's not a big concern. But hadith is not like that. Hadith is very different. So you have some ahadith which appear in many books right from those original and sources of hadith close to the time of the Holy Prophet. And they are multiple in number. But you have many other ahadith that, for example, this hadith only appears in this one single book, for example. Or it appears in one book, and that book also was written 300 years after the Holy Prophet. And we cannot trace it in that period of 300 years. So hadith can have very many different ways in which it can reach us. Quran, we know, as it has reached us as one single book with that sequence that we have, and it's amazing. Like it comes with such a solid authenticity in terms of its transmission. So one of the key pursuits that we have, academic pursuit in terms of hadith, is authenticity of hadith. And you know what's interesting is that Muslims were aware of this thing, and therefore soon after the Holy Prophet left this world, Muslims started developing these sciences. So they started developing the science of hadith, of how these hadiths are recorded.
And unfortunately, the recording of a hadith, at least among certain groups of Muslims, was prohibited. So they faced a challenge.
Yeah, so that was a challenge they faced. And although really we don't have time here, I'll really say this to my audience that it's even very interesting to pursue a bit of history of hadith, that how did it happen in certain sects we have in Islam, how did it happen amongst the Shias, how these things progress. We won't have time to go into all the details. We have this thing that recording of hadith was prohibited, but of course it didn't mean that all the hadith was lost. People had memorized it, they would transfer from one generation to another. I think it's difficult to imagine the culture of that time and the environment. Sometimes we think we compare it to our own environment. No, hadith was a big thing.
If
I knew a hadith from Rasul, I would protect it with all my energy. I would teach it to people and go and spread it, and I would transmit it. So that culture was then amongst the Muslims. A time came, it started being recorded. In the Shia world, it had a different history of how it started recording. But of course, we're not going into
details. I guess you can see the importance Muslims gave to hadith just by the fact that people abused it. Exactly. You can only abuse something which is, if it's given importance by some people, then you go and misuse that and to go. So that's definitely
one of the very important pursuits and concerns of Muslims, those early Muslims, was like hadith
being protected,
spread it, transmitted. It's a source of religion. Sunnah of Rasulullah was a big thing, that even those very minute details about his life, that look, he used to enter house with, for example, his right feet. So they would record it, not only record, they would act upon it. The sunnah was a big thing at that time, that people would try to copy the sunnah of the Holy Prophet in different aspects. So it's an interesting part of the story. So our main concern today, so we have a gap from that time, is to talk about the authenticity of ahadith, which are authentic, which are not authentic. What do we even mean by authenticity? What is the process used to establish authenticity of the ahadith? Of course, it's a technical discussion. We're looking at the processes behind a lot. But to the extent necessary for our course on Imamah, we would want to do it.
So just before we enter, there's different schools of or methodologies of going about ahadith. Different scholars have their own ways, and some scholars are known for their ways being different to others. When you're going to present this, are you going to be taking one scholar's methodology, or are you talking something that's more general?
So definitely what we would do here is that we are not sticking to a specific person's or a specific scholar's methodology. What we're going to do is, we're going to do two things. One is we're going to look at those methods which are commonly agreed by everyone,
mm-hmm.
and which you would also agree when I present it to you. Okay. It would be clear, it would be easy for us to accept that, okay, this is a valid method. That's one. And in some cases, we'll go to the most common and the mashhoor method that's used by a great number of scholars. And mm-hmm. scholars, we mean experts in the field. So both of these are going to help us form a relatively a clear and good picture of how these things function. And authenticating ahadith, what does it involve? Yeah. Of course, it's going to be a very brief discussion with only a few examples. So we get a taste of it. It's not a full discussion about hadith or rijal and sanad and how do you do establish authenticity. We're going to refer to parts that we need for our discussion. Yeah.
If I can just add that somebody is wondering, why should we even bother, you know? So I've seen this before that some people say that, why should we bother spending so much time on a hadith when we know there's so many issues, there's so many difference of opinions and all that. Let's just put it aside and stick to the Quran. But that doesn't work, because we just established that the Quran itself told us, go and follow the Prophet. There is crucial, necessary information that you will find with the Prophet, which is the Sunnah, which is the hadith, right? It's expressed in the hadith. So you can't just say, okay, because now it's complicated to access the hadith, let's just put it on the side and just stick to the Quran.
So let me tell you something interesting. So in the last Muharram, I was in a certain place for reciting majalis, and I had a meeting with a certain group of people who had questions regarding this. So this is exactly the same question one of them asked. That, look, hadith is such a mess. There are contradictions there. There are things that we don't understand. We have Quran, which is so clear. And I'm using these. Throw the hadith out of the window and stick to the Quran.
I've had the analogy of I've seen the analogy of a poisoned cake. If you know there's a cake that's poisoned, parts of it are poisoned, parts of it are not, why take the risk? Just get rid of the whole cake.
So at that time, this example came to my mind to explain that how silly is this idea. Okay, and that is that. So I told them. So those people, they had kids. So I told them that, look, you have kids at home. There's so many valuable toys at home, valuable things. Your kids decided to wreck the house. So what they did, you're outside, and you told them that be at home, you have some urgent work to go. And they decided to go on a crazy run, and they completely messed up the house. They put things, mixed toys, valuable things. They even took out gold from drawer and just they put it, just random things. Okay, now you come home, you say, oh my God, such a big mess. Let me get a few trash bags, put everything in the trash bag and throw it out of the window. Would you accept that as a valid thing? Firstly, let me say this. Hadith is an exaggerated thing to them. It's such a mess and you can't understand. So first, we wouldn't agree that. But I would say, even if it is a mess, let's just even suppose it is a mess, because we know it's a source that Allah has told. Allah is saying there's gold there. There's life for you there. There's guidance for you there. Even if it's a mess, my intellect tells me, let me go and clear the mess. Let me separate gold from trash. And let me trash the trash, not trash the gold. Doesn't make any sense.
Whatever at least is that minimum you can get out of it, at least it's worth that effort,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. So if something is like the children completely wrecked it, like it's gone now, you can't use it again, that's fine. But there are many things that you can just go, clear up the house, remove the trash, put the toys which are okay in their own place, and you'll be surprised with, oh wow, the gold is here. Alhamdulillah, I was careful.
And just to build on this analogy, gold is such that kids can do nothing to destroy it. It's solid and is going to stay forever, and nobody's going to be able to destroy it.
This analogy would help saying that it becomes a duty to go behind this pursuit of finding the authentic hadith. And that's what the ulama would do. That's what the Muslim would do. They'd say that, look, hadith is very important. It's a gold mine. These teachings, and really, I think maybe you don't have an idea. Maybe you don't have connection to hadith. You go into these ahadith on different topics. Imam's talking about tarbiyah. You're like, wow,
it's beautiful.
This is the gold mine. So let me say this here. Sometimes you feel really sad that some people, out of their, I don't know what to say, ignorance, less knowledge, they take such a harsh approach with respect to hadith that eventually the way they talk about hadith, it ends up raising hadith to ground, like it can be bulldozing hadith as a complete whole. No, don't do that. You're doing a big disservice to people. You're breaking the connection between people and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And how important are these teachings? So this famous narration from Imam al-Radai comes and says that you don't need to like force people to come to us, the Ahlul Bayt. You just go and teach them our words. لَوْ أَلِمَ النَّاسِ مَحَاسِنَ كَلَامِنَا لَتَّبَعُونَ. You just tell them these beautiful teachings that we have of the Ahlul Bayt, people will follow. So I feel taking this very harsh approach to hadith is a big, big disservice to the people. Because we have some wrong hadith, and we'll talk about that, you want to just discard everything and miss out on those life-giving teachings that we have from the Ahlul Bayt. So, I mean, I'm just expressing it. It's a sad thing that you feel that, why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
A more rational approach is that you say that, okay, if you're concerned about authenticity of the hadith, fine. Let's go and look at the ways to find the authentic ones from the unauthentic ones. We leave those which are not authentic, and then we stick and benefit
and
from the
authentic. And even when you talk about authentic, we mean authentic in a specific way, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the next discussion we would have is to a bit try and get an insight into this idea of authenticating hadith.
Okay.
So we're going to dive into that. So
I think you'll make it clear what we mean by authentic, because from what I know of how the ulama work, it's not just because something is not authentic you don't use it, right?
So now, so what I'll do is I'll come to this meaning of what do we mean when we say a certain hadith is authentic. It has two different meanings when we say a certain hadith is authentic. But before that, I just want to put things in perspective that when we talk about authenticity of hadith, what are we talking? So I'll divide it into three stages. So hadith, the words of the Holy Prophet, and later if the Imam is true, and the words of the A'imma, they have three stages to it before they reach us.
Okay.
So we are sitting here in the 21st century and reading a certain hadith. How did it reach us? Three stages. One, stage number one is when that first narrator heard it directly from the Imam. That's the first step, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, you have Zurar, you have Muhammad ibn Muslim. And Imam Sadiq is speaking to him and he's listening. That's the spark, that's the first place where this hadith, this knowledge was given. So that's one. The second stage is that this hadith was preserved, recorded, and even written. I mean, so I would probably come to this later even a bit with more detail, that there was the Ahlul Bayt inculcated a certain culture of recording hadith. It wasn't just that I'm casually sitting there listening to what Imam Sadiq is saying, I half remember it, and then I go home, I gather some students, and they said, oh, I think Imam Sadiq said this. It wasn't like that. There was a lot of precision here. So just to emphasize on this part, let me just read a narration. This is from Abi Basir. Okay. Again, I haven't authenticated this hadith, but I'm trying to say that these kind of things you'll find
in multiple places in the
hadith. Yeah. So it says, "An Abi Basir qal dakhaltu ala Abi Abdullah alayhi salam." So entered in the presence of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Faqal, "Ma yamna'akum min al-kitab?" He's talking to the companions and saying that, "Why don't you write?" I mean, I'm saying it in my words, like saying that, what stops you from writing what I'm saying? Innakum lan tahfadhu hatta taktubu. You won't protect these gems I'm giving you, this knowledge I'm giving you. You won't remember, you won't protect unless you write. Then he says that, innahu kharaja min indi rahtun min ahli al-Basra. So he said, one of these days, a group of people from Basra came to me, sa'aluni an ashiya, they asked me about questions about different things. Fakatabuha, they wrote it down, and I liked it. That, I'm saying it in this way. So that, look, I'm the Imam. I'm here to guide you. What I'm telling you is unique, exclusive. You won't find this knowledge anywhere. It's important to write it. So there was a certain culture of recording a hadith that the Ahlul Bayt were promoting and teaching these narrators. So it right from the beginning. So this is important, right? The first connection that we have to this hadith is that these first listeners and writers of the hadith. So that's one step. The step number two was that these ahadith, which were written, recorded, memorized by these first narrators, now they would transfer it to the next generation of transmitters of hadith. In a very specific way, I won't go into the detail. It was a very, very unique system. So a teacher, for example, Muhammad ibn Muslim now is a teacher. He would have disciples. He would teach these hadith to them. He would tell the students, write them. And when you have written them, come, I'll recheck them. Mm. So they had this idea of qira'ah. Yeah. If you want to pursue this, there's a science called ilmul diraya, very brief one. So Shahid Awwal or Shahid Thani has a brief book on that. He talks about these different ways that these ahadith were transmitted. It's called dirayatul hadith. So it's amazing, right? Like a teacher teaches these ahadith. So for example, teacher had 100 hadith from Imam Sadiq, who teach it to like a few students, tell them write it and come and read it for me. I'll approve it. So sometimes they would even like sign it and approve it. So there was a whole culture.
So I remember in many of the books, the teacher, the amount of hadith that was discussed that day, the teacher would come and write on their notebooks the sign that we've reached over here. And a lot of times we can authenticate if this book was actually gone through this process or not by seeing the actual writing of the companion.
It's important to imagine and put into perspective the culture of recording hadith in amongst the Shia. It would be an interesting discussion to go, but we'll digress on the main topic. So step one, the first listener listens, the first narrator, Rawi.
Yeah.
Now, the second step is he transmits it to the next generation. He would also write it. Then to the next generation, and it's being transmitted. Until you reach a point that these narrations that had these different chains of people were compiled into these big, massive books. Okay. So this is stage two. These narrations being written, recorded, many times into small, small books, booklets. So if you want, you can pursue this idea of usul arba mi'a. So usul would be these small books of hadith, particular to a particular narrator. So a few of those have remained. We have them, that this is the asl related to this person. So these are basically his personal diary of ahadith. He would have recorded it there. And then what happened, some of the scholars, and we should really thank them, they had this insight that, look, you have these so many ahadiths, why not collect them into one book? So you have Muhammad ibn Ya'qub al-Kulayni doing this amazing job of collecting, putting together all these ahadiths in his famous book, Al-Kafi. So that's the second step. Once these ahadiths were combined into these well-formed, famous books, then these books now would be transmitted to us. Okay, so Why did I make it into three steps? Because step one and step three is not a problem for us. Step one is not a problem. Why? Because if someone listens to a hadith directly from the imam, there's no chain, there's no question of authenticating it.
Authenticity is not an issue. It's the understanding is the issue.
So that he needs to sort, that he shouldn't misunderstand. He should listen properly. But there's no transmission. So step one is not a problem. Step three is also not a problem. Because once these books were compiled, we have those manuscripts, the original manuscripts of these important books, Al-Kafi, Man La Yahdurul Faqih, and all these famous books that are there. Once they're put into books, they were kind of protected because now the copies of that books were made, multiple copies, they're preserved. And it's a whole interesting thing if you want to pursue. So you have these, for example, in the holy city of Qom, you have this, the library of Ayatollah Marashi. So he took it on himself to gather these manuscripts, these very, very old ones. Yeah. For example, Astan-e-Quds-e Radhawi, the Imam Radha Shrine, they have a big setup where they collect these original manuscripts. So that's a whole world. So that's not a problem because once Al-Kafi was made and it was copied enough number of times, it was transmitted without issue. So part number two is what we come to discuss, that this transmission from the time of Imam Sadiq to the time of Kulayni. So this thing, if we establish authenticity in this period and where you have this idea of having chains of transmission, different narrators, their authenticity, are they thicker or not, can we trust them or not, all these things, they come into. So I've just tried to put it in perspective. I know it's all of this needs explanation. I tried to keep it brief, but again, my time anyways is limited. So I would have really liked to talk about the culture of Hadith. And I began talking about it, that how was the culture, how careful the narrators were. I wouldn't have time to go into a lot of details, and probably, I think I am, because I saw the lineup of the topics, when there's a discussion about Ghuluv, this thing would be discussed.
Okay.
Because what's happening right now, and the thing, I'll say this in a very brief, in a few minutes, is that what's happening right now, that some people are trying to portray this picture about Shia Hadith, that look, the Hadith that we have was tampered with, was changed. The Jews did it, the Zoroastrians put so many of their ahadith, those Kadhab people, those liars, fabricators, they put, the Ghulat came and messed up with the Shia hadith. And eventually, the hadith compilation that we have is you can't actually
it's
rely on.
Tampered with so much.
It's tampered with so much that you feel so uncomfortable that anywhere you put your finger, you say that, oh, maybe this is, there's a high chance that this is a picture, this is an idea that is being presented by some people. As long as this idea is an academic question and pursuit, we don't mind it. Why? Because the answers would be given.
And to be fair, the academic pursuit is being done. This is what the Hosa does, basically.
Exactly.
Does all these.
Yeah, so I remember we have a teacher. So in class, whenever we would ask a question, and we would ask with a lot of this thing that, oh, we have found that question, now he can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
So listen to the question carefully, he would say, it's a really good question. Then he would pause and say, but the answer is better. yes, the questions can be raised. So this is a question that there, that has the Shia Hadith been tampered with so much that it's very shaky, you can't rely on it? If we would have an insight into the culture that the Ahlul Bayt had promoted of recording the hadith, the precision that went into, for example, just to give an example, like Ghulat were trying to tamper with the hadith. The Imams came and they took a very strong stance against. The beliefs of the Ghulat and the true Shia beliefs, where the difference was clear. The Ashab, the narrators of hadith, could make a difference between these. There was a culture that whenever people, then these narrators would have doubt about a hadith, they would go and show these books of hadith to the Imams, double check it. So we have instances where it's like this narrator brought this, saying that this is the hadith book, the personal hadith diary of this. Can you check it?
Yeah.
And the Imam would go through all of it and say that, okay, all of it is fine. So again, I'm not going into the details.
Yeah. We'll discuss more of this with Shah.
So I'm sure, yeah. So that would come in Ghulat. The bottom line is that Imams played an active role in managing the recording of hadith. So that this is an important thing. Why? Because it was an important concern for them. They're concerned that these things would be tampered with. And another point which I'll say here, it comes from, because this is an issue has been going on. It has been going on in the history and now. So even recently, a few years ago, someone, I wouldn't mention the name, came and said a certain thing like that, that most of our ahadith, a good number, have been actually fabricated by the Jews. The Ka'bul Ahbars and this kind of... So Ka'bul Ahbar is an interesting character in Islamic history. Or the Zoroastrians, and he came and said this person. So Ayatollah Hashimi Shahrudi, marhum, he passed away a few years ago, one of the well-known fuqaha for times. He was one of the top students of Shaheed Sadr. So he gave an answer to this thing. And one of the things, I can share that answer with you. One of the things that's very clear is that he's clearly upset that, look, anyone who has a bit of idea of how the culture of recording hadith was amongst the Shia, he wouldn't have these questions.
Hmm.
And then one of the points he mentions, and which I want to bring it here, is the taqwa and the piety of these narrators.
Yeah.
That it was a concern for them. It wasn't the case that they're saying that, oh, the Ghulat are coming and tampering with the hadith, the Jews are coming and tampering, and they're saying that...
And just stay idle and not do anything about it. Yeah.
And not do... No, they're concerned. They're pious people. They were smart people. Let me just read one hadith for you about... It's good to know these things. The station of these these narrators that we have. So let me just quickly read. It's interesting. It's adds even, it will give you a bit of change as well. So this is a narration, says سمعت أبا عبد الله يقول ميجي ما أحد أحيا ذكرنا وأحاديث أبي. No one has made alive our remembrance and the ahadith of my father, Imam Sadiq is saying, illa Zurara wa Abu Basir, Muhammad ibn Muslim, Burayd ibn Muawiyah al-Ijli. He never mentions these four. These are like the top companions. He says, walawla ha'ulai ma kana ahadun yastambitu hada. No one would get to the knowledge that we're presenting. Then he says, ha'ulai huffadu deen. These are the protectors of religion. Wa umana'u abi. They are the trustworthy people that my father trusted for what? Ala halalillahi wa haramihi. Imam Bakir is trusting these people with Allah's halal and haram. It's a big thing. And then he says, wa humu sabiquna ilayna fid dunya wa sabiquna ilayna fil akhirah. So look, these are special people, these four
this
names.
This is amazing. Yeah.
And these you say those big and famous heavyweight narrators that we have. So four are mentioned here. And you have this idea of Ashabul Ijma, these big, in the term they call Ajilla, the great and the big, the heavyweights in narrations. Yeah. These were pious people. These were smart people. These are concerned people. So you understand this, you understand the culture, you understand the sensitivity that the imams themselves had when it comes to recording hadith. You put all this together. So Ayatullah Hashmi Shahrudi, in that letter and response he wrote, says that you just need to be a bit aware of the history of hadith to realize that it's incorrect to say that a lot of it was tampered. So we're not saying that nothing was tampered.
Yeah, you need to be aware of the whole history, not just a part of it. Because like recently I was reading this work by one of the scholars, that was also a Shia scholar, and you can see that he's only taken one side of it. Like his whole historical discussion of the growth of tashayyu and of ahadith, you can see from clearly from his work that it is only taking one side. So we need to look at both, the whole picture, and then make a conclusion out of it. And then maybe if somebody wants to then still reach to his own conclusion, good.
That's up to him. But let's bring the facts.
Let's bring the whole picture. Yeah.
So all of these, I'm saying that this culture was there, the emphasis on recording the hadith was there, the sensitivity towards
the fact that things were being put in books and those books were being checked by the scholars. So the, basically.
So all of this, and I hope a more detailed discussion would come later. So, I don't know how much time do I have, and so, how are we going to continue discussion?
So we have a bit of time. So we thought that we'll add one more section to this session. It'll make the session a bit longer, but I think that a discussion is interesting enough. Okay, for the brothers and sisters to stay on for a bit longer. And we'll have another break as well before the next section. But I think we should finish because we don't have another opportunity to discuss these things.
And I think I've reached the point where now I want to say those very key important things. Because we want to get a bit of insight into the process of authentication and what happens as a result of authenticating a hadith. Like, what do we mean by it? Yeah. So because if you have a bit of time, it will really help. It will complete the discussion and it will set the stage for the forthcoming.
Yeah. I think it's important we talk about authenticity because it's a term that's loosely being thrown around. So, for example, we do have scholars even today and in the past who easily dismiss a hadith. Right, where for example they even reduce Al-Kafi from its 8 volumes to, for example, very few volumes, on the understanding that those ahadith were not authentic. Okay, but then when you see those scholars, somehow their beliefs and some of their actions are still in line with non-authentic ahadith. So what they meant by authentic might be different. Like the word authentic is maybe misunderstood.
Yeah. So I think this is something which we definitely need to go into, and we'll come to this idea that authenticity can actually have two meanings.
Okay.
So we'll use this idea that when I say this hadith is authentic, it can mean a certain thing. And also when I say it's authentic, I mean another thing. And then if I don't separate these two meanings, it can lead to a lot of confusion. So exactly the same thing. So with meaning number one, I say this is not authentic. Okay, so automatically someone might be inclined to say, oh, it's unauthentic, that means it has no value.
Yeah.
But no, I can come and say, and we'll explain this, that with this one meaning, it's not authentic and it means a certain thing. But this thing which is not authentic according to the first meaning, you can combine other things and put together different...
It has values, basically.
It has a certain value and you can complete its value to make it authentic in the second meaning. I'll try and explain it. I think we should continue it after the break.
Yeah. So, brothers and sisters, so we will make this session a little bit longer. We think it is worth it. These are things that you need to hear because they're really setting the way for the rest of the course as well. And they're very new discussions. They're not being discussed normally. And we've got an opportunity. This opportunity is not going to come back. So I really think that we should extend it a little bit. So we'll have another, we'll have a short break and then we'll continue and extend the discussion for a bit longer. So have a quick break and then we'll be back, inshallah.
Yeah, and I promise that I won't make it very long. Yes. So please do come back, inshallah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ويطوف عليهم ولدان مخلدون إذا رأيتهم حسبتهم لؤلؤا منثورا وإذا رأيت ثم رأيت نعيما وملكا كبيرا عاليهم ثياب سندس خضر وإستبرق وحلوا أساور من فضة وسقاهم ربهم شرابا طهورا إن هذا كان لكم جزاء وكان سعيكم مشكورا إنا نحن نزلنا عليك القرآن تنزيلا فاصبر لحكم ربك ولا تطع منهم آثما أو كفورا واذكر اسم ربك بكرة وأصيلا ومن الليل فاسجد له وسبحه ليلا طويلا إن هؤلاء يحبون العاجلة ويذرون وراءهم يوما ثقيلا نحن خلقناهم وشددنا أسرهم وإذا شئنا بدلنا أمثالهم تبديلا إن هذه تذكرة فمن شاء اتخذ إلى ربه سبيلا وما تشاءون إلا أن يشاء الله إن الله كان عليما حكيما يدخل من يشاء في رحمته والظالمين أعد لهم عذابا أليما صدق الله العلي العظيم
اللهم صل وسلم وزد وبارك على رسول الله وآله الطهار على رسول الله وآله الطهار
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum once again. Thanks for staying over for this extra slightly longer session. I know it's getting a bit long for one session, but with the breaks, hopefully it makes it a bit easier for you. And I think the discussion is quite interesting. It's quite a novel discussion that's not usually there in many places. So hopefully the interesting part of the discussion is removing your tiredness. So let's get back to it. We were talking about authenticity, and there is two understandings of authenticity, right? So there are certain hadith that we call authentic, some of them we call da'if, and the perception that many people have, especially amongst the laymen, is that if a hadith is da'if, it's useless, we put it on the side. Now, when I'm saying this, I know as a fact that somebody might be thinking, okay, obviously, if it's da'if, then why? What reason would you have to keep it?
Yeah, it's weak.
Yeah, it's weak. Just get rid of it. Yeah, you're trying to bring excuses to try and save something just because you want to prove imamat. Right?
So I think we have come to a very sensitive and critical part of our discussion, and I'll really urge my audience to pay complete attention here, because this is a really, really important part. And what's actually happening here is that there's a confusion between two different meanings of authenticity. Okay, and I'll have to explain this very precisely. So let me begin with the first and the standard meaning of authenticity of hadith. So how does it work? So you have a hadith, and the standard way, or one of the common ways of talking about authenticity of a certain hadith, is to look at the authenticity of the narrators of the hadith.
Yeah.
So you have this idea called the chain of narration. Yeah. It's called in Arabic sanad. Each sanad and chain consists of different individuals from the imam to the writer of the book. Yeah. So for example, I just mentioned a narration from Usul al-Kafi for you, right? So I read this. إِنَّ الْإِمَامِ إِذَا شَاءَ أَنْ يَعْلَمْ أُلِّمْ. This is a narration. It's in Usul al-Kafi. It has a sanad. It has a chain of narration. So just to give you an idea how these things work, let me read it. Read this chain. So it says,
go for it. Yeah.
Ali ibn Muhammad wa gayruhu an Sahl ibn Ziyad. So it's telling, Marhum Kulaini is saying that I'm narrating it from Ali ibn Muhammad wa gayruhu, from another person. So from two people, and Sahl ibn Ziyad, and Ayyub ibn Nuh, and Safwan ibn Yahya, and Ibn Muskan, and Badr ibn Walid, and Abi Rabi al-Shami, and Abi Abdullah. So you see this chain.
Okay.
So the first person who's heard it from Imam al-Sadiq is this person named Abi Rabi al-Shami. He told it to the next one, to the next one. So we have these four or five people, and this chain reaches the writer of the book, which is Muhammad ibn Yaqub al-Kulayni. Okay. From Kulayni onwards, still up till here, you don't have a problem, because it's part of a book now, and that book has been preserved. Now, one way of authenticating this hadith is to go and check each narrator and ask, is this narrator authentic or not? Is he a reliable person or not? In other words, is he a thicker or not? So thicker in Arabic means reliable.
Yeah.
So what you do, you look at each single person and you ask the question, is he reliable or not? How do you answer this question? We have books of Rijal written by the Rijali experts of that time. So you have Kashi, you have Najashi, you have Ibn Ghazairi, you have Sheikh Tusi, and even you can benefit from words of others. They have written books where they talk about these individuals and tell you. For example, they take a name. So for example, Safwan ibn Yahya is a famous name. So Safwan ibn Yahya, thicker than. So for example, we have this software that just you type the name and the thing comes. For example, let me do it right here. So I've opened Al-Kafi.
Yeah.
I've typed Safwan ibn Yahya. It tells me that there are 610 narrations in Al-Kafi from Safwan ibn Yahya. Okay. Now let me read for you. So Rijal Tusi, Sheikh Tusi in his Rijal says, Thikatun imamiyun sahihul madhab zahir. Done. Sheikh Tusi, as an expert of Rijal, is telling me he's thicker.
Yeah.
There's other Rijal Kashi say, so basically Safwan ibn Yahya is a reliable narrator. Yeah. So just giving you an insight of how. So if you're able to establish all the people in this chain are reliable, then you say this hadith is authentic. And based on this, you have this classification of hadith into four types. So you say hadith is either sahih, it's either hasan, or it's muwathak, or it's daif. So I'm deliberately bringing these terminologies because this idea of a daif hadith is coming from this classification and this terminology, which is the work of Allama Hilli. So he's the one who solidified this classification, says that a hadith are four types. I don't want to get into the technicalities, but you know what a sahih hadith is? A sahih hadith is something where all the people in the chain of narration are reliable and also 12ers, imami. So they're isna'ashir.
Yep.
So if you find a hadith where all of these are like this, it's sahih.
It's sahih in the sense that the people are...
People have these two qualities. So sahih becomes the top level of authenticity. You say that, okay, if it's sahih. What if some of the narrators, what if all are reliable, they're thicker, but some of them, for example, are not Shia. For example, they're Ahlus Sunnah. For example, they're Zaydi. For example, other Islamic sects. Such a narration, they would call it as muwathak. So basically, they don't have the right akidah, for example. But they're reliable people. They would relate. So this is muwathak. Hasan is a narration whereby some people in the chain of narrations, their authenticity and reliability is not established, but all of them are 12ers. So that becomes the hasan. And the fourth type of narration, so we are looking at one idea of authenticity, right? Authenticity only based on the chain. We're not looking at other factors.
On the people who are reporting it.
And that would be the standard way of looking at authenticity of any narration, right? If someone quotes to me with two people in between, the natural thing for me to look at those people, right? And say, is it authentic or not? So this is one way, and you have this classification of hadith. What the scholars who talk about authenticity from this perspective say is that if a hadith is sahih or muwathak, we accept it. It's authentic. Okay. Why do we say it's authentic and we can rely on it? And when I say rely on it, it means a lot. It means that a faqih can give a fatwa based on it, even though he might not have absolute certainty that this is from Imam Sadiq. Okay. So basically, in technical words, this sahih hadith or a muwathak hadith has hujjiyah. It has a value. And if you really want those technical words in English, hujjiyah is called probative force. It needs explanation that why it's been translated to that, but I'm not doing that. So basically, hujjiyah means that imams have sanctioned us that you can use the ahadith which are either sahih or muwathak. Okay, and of course, this needs a discussion that where have imams sanctioned this? And we have proofs for that imams have sanctioned us to use the ahadith which come from narrators who are reliable. No. So this is one.
Although that would be that would be in the case that there is no reason to put that hadith on the question, right? Yeah.
Okay. So again, so this is a very. So if I'm only looking at the chain of transmission, I'm okay. I can use this hadith, but when it comes to its content. I'll have to again check it back with the other reliable narration. So if there's another reliable narration whose content contradicts with this sahih narration, then I'll have to even work out a solution for that. So that's the discussion on ta'arud.
That's very interesting that if it's sahih, then how come it's contradicting? That means it's not sahih. So something is sahih but not sahih.
Yeah, so basically what they would say is that if there are two sahih hadiths that are head-to-head contradicting each other, like this is important, head-to-head completely, entirely, it tells us that one of these hadiths is not actually hujjah. It's not actually something we can rely. Now, how do you resolve this? How do you prefer one or the other? It's a discussion. I'll refer to usulul fiqh. You go there, you'll study that. But again, we don't want to get into the technical stuff. So I come back to this idea of authenticating based on sanad. okay, on the chain of narration. So this is one meaning of a hadith being authentic. So what happens here is that this is very interesting. Let's think about this, that okay, you have a hadith and there is a narrator in that hadith whose reliability is not established. Okay, what does it mean when we say his reliability is not established? It can mean many different things. Sometimes it can mean that this person, for example, is a kadhab, he is a fabricator. How do we know? The books of Rijal
tell us.
For example, this person was there, Abil Khattab. So you go and check the books of Rijal. This says kadhabun, falanun, fabricator, all that. So sometimes you have a narrator who's a liar. Okay. But many, many times when we say a hadith is dha'if, is where it's not because there is someone in that chain of narration who's a liar, who's a fabricator. It's just because these Rijali scholars haven't mentioned anything about this person. Neither have they said he's thicker, nor they have said he's not a thicker. Let me give you a famous example of a hadith. I'm giving this example because you can search online. So there's this famous narration called the Maqbula of Umar ibn Hanzala. So Umar ibn Hanzala is a narrator. And there's this a very important narration. There's a lot of significance in fiqh, which talks about the authority of the scholars in Ghaiba. So it's talking about authority of the scholars in Ghaiba. And fuqaha have discussed it a lot. So here, they don't call this narration sahih. You know why? Because Umar ibn Hanzala, neither does he have tawseek, whereby these Rijali scholars are saying he's a thicker, like I showed for Safwan ibn Yahya. Nor has anyone said that he was a kadhab. So we are left in we don't know.
So from the perspective of each person being
a reliable person.
Proved to have been reliable.
We would call this riwayat, we'll say it's not authentic.
Yeah, it's not authentic.
In fact, they would classify it as dha'if. Okay. But this is where a lot of confusion comes. This dha'if doesn't mean weak in the sense that it has no value.
Yeah.
It just means that it doesn't reach that level of authenticity where we wanted every single person to be a reliable transmitter in that
shape. Can we say, no, rather than level, because then it sounds like there's... Doesn't mean that meaning of authenticity.
Yeah. So we'll come to examples.
Because it seemed like this meaning of authenticity is just a terminology. It's a classification. Just to, let's say, simplify things.
Exactly. And this classification and even some of these terminologies, names attached to it, have led to confusion. So this terminology was devised to classify things, make things clear, and help the fuqaha give fatwa, for example. So a faqih would look at a narration, and you would say, okay, the sanad is sahih, I can give fatwa. Sanad is mu'athab, I can give fatwa. The other two is now the question, what do the fuqaha do if they have a dha'if narration? So on the positive side, if they see a sahih narration or a mu'athab narration, they do definitely give fatwa. But on the other side, it's not the case that if a narration just based on the sanad is dha'if, they disregard it. No. There's another meaning of authenticity that comes into picture.
Okay.
And this is where the discussion becomes very interesting.
Yeah.
And what's that other meaning of authenticity? That other meaning is that based on sanad, you couldn't establish this is a sahih narration, which you can give fatwa based on that. But let us say this narration is such that you have enough evidence surrounding it, historical, contextual, content-based evidence, and other sets of evidence. And I'll come to that, what those pieces of evidence are, such that if you combine this different evidence, which is not to do with the sanad, it's an external. So in terms of sanad, it's not a sahih narration. In this classification, you'll say it's dha'if. But this same hadith, which is dha'if, weak, if you take this and have other pieces of evidence put together, if you reach certainty, qat, yakin, or near certainty, itminan, then this hadith, which according to the first meaning is dha'if, is reliable, authentic, according to the second meaning, whereby you would say that I have reached itminan, I have reached near certainty, and I know that this has been said by the Imam. I have itminan regarding this.
Can I define the second meaning of authenticity to mean that if something is proven to come from the Imam, regardless of how you've proven it, then you say that's authentic. It's true, maybe in the sanads it might not be authentic, that meaning of authentic.
The first meaning, yeah.
But the sanad is not the only way to prove something is from the Imam.
So I think you said it very, very beautifully, and I think we should, I would underline this sentence, that sanad is not the only way to prove authenticity. It is one of the ways, but not the only way to prove authenticity.
So can we put it like this? If we want to understand why this confusion is happening, can we say that, look, generally, the sanad really helps in showing authenticity. Yeah. And therefore, the ulama came and made classifications to see which ones of these asnad are sahih, which ones are not. So that majority of the case, this is also the second meaning of authenticity. Exactly. It comes from Imam. But we have scenarios where something in the terminology sense, in the sanad, is not
sahih. In fact, it's da'if in that terminology.
But we have other evidence that show it is from the Imam. And the other side as well, we can also say that something may be sahih in sanad, but we have evidence that it actually wasn't from the Imam.
Yeah. So,
and so basically, at the end of the day, when you look at both sides, it's clear that the sanad isn't the defining factor
in accepting or not accepting a hadith.
It was
an important factor.
Yeah, it's an important help to know if something comes from the Imam. So if I can again put it this way, what we're looking for is finding, did the Imam say this or not?
Exactly.
This is what we're looking for. Yeah. Can I prove it one way or the other? If I'm able to give a solid proof that this comes from the Imam, then I take it, whether in a sanadi perspective is correct or not.
Exactly. And
problem, Sheikhna.
Yes.
We have scholars who base the whole authenticity just on sanads. Do we not?
Give me an example of that.
I don't like to mention names.
Okay. So I think I'll enter into this discussion slightly. So I hope, and I'm inshallah praying, that I've been able to put across this concept properly, because this is a key concept, that sanad is not the only way to show authenticity. There are other ways, and I'll come to that. So, for example, Shahid Sad, Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sad, in his famous textbook on Usul al-Fiqh, the Halakat, which are called, so it's called Durusun fi Ilm al-Usul. So there are three levels of that. In the third section, the third Halaka, he talks about what are those other factors that help us authenticate a hadith other than the sanad. So I'll come to that. But before that, there's this idea, and I'll even mention the name, there's no harm in doing that, that it's been said, it's out there, and it's been attributed to Marhum Ayatullah al-Uzma Khoi, that he only believed in authentication based on sanad, and that's it. And if you cannot establish that this hadith is sahih based on sanad, that every single person is a thika, is a reliable narrator, then this hadith cannot be used at all. This is a perception that is presented about him in some circles by some people. What I want to tell and say here very clearly, with a lot of emphasis, that this is a completely incorrect attribution to Marhum Ayatullah al-Khoi.
Okay.
And why do I say it? I'm going to read from his own book.
Okay.
And before I read, let me tell you what Ayatullah Khoi believes. So what Marhum Ayatullah al-Uzma Khoi believes is what I just exactly explained right now. So he says that if you have a sanad that's sahih or muwathak, because the key thing that he's looking for is reliability. The madhab is not so important. His Shia or Sunni, it doesn't affect this meaning of authenticity. So he says that if a certain sanad is sahih, definitely that's authentic. But that doesn't mean that I have no other way of accepting and authenticating hadith. He himself says, and I'm going to quote, that if you have evidence, qara'an, to reach itminan about this hadith, that this was actually said by the imam, of course it's hujjah, of course it's reliable. So I'll read this portion for you. this is important because Ayatollah Khoi was a big figure, right? I mean, he's one of the, probably the greatest fuqaha we have had.
Yeah.
The amount of services done to the fiqh, to the fiqaha, to the marja'iyah is amazing. And now, some people, if they bring Ayatollah Khoi on one side and put you against him, you stand no chance of any survival. Yeah. So
whether Ayatollah Khoi believes in what you're going to say or not, inshallah, you've got the text and you'll read it out for us. But let's assume we didn't have this and Sayyid Khoi did believe in that.
Yeah.
Well, it's his academic opinion.
Yeah.
And with all due respect to all the scholars that we have, at the end of the day, we can disagree.
Yeah.
And we have very big fuqaha who have this opinion of not authenticating only based on sanad.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, when we feel like pushing for our certain view, we pick that big scholar that matches with ours.
Yeah, at least give some chance to the other big fuqaha and scholars.
Yeah, I mean, there's both views out there in the Hawza, but then you're suggesting Sayyid Khoi is not of that opinion.
In fact, he doesn't believe in such a thing. It's an incorrect attribution to him. So let me read this part for you. So even if you want, I'll give the address. If you want some, so it's Misbahul Usul. So it's one of his Usuli books, volume 2, page number 240.
Okay.
It's part of a technical discussion, so I don't want to. It'll be a bit difficult for me to explain all of that, but I'll try my best. So he's talking about this idea of authenticating hadith. So he says that إِنَّ الْمَعْرُوفَ الْمَشْهُورُ بَيْنَهُمْ, the mashhur opinion of the scholars, the Usuli scholars, is injabaru dha'fi sanad bi amali al-mashhur. So there's this discussion in Usulul Fiqh whereby they say that if you have a dha'if narration, but you see that those fuqaha at that time, despite the sanad not being sahih, they acted upon it.
Yeah. So they used to act on the content of this.
Of the content of it, does that authenticate it? It's a discussion. So this is called injibaru sanad, that the sanad is not complete, it's not sahih, it's not muwathaq, and yet we can now trust this narration.
Yeah.
It makes up. So the classical example of that is the same Maqbula of Umar ibn Hanzala. It's called Maqbula because it was Maqbul and accepted and acted upon by those initial scholars, the mutakaddimin, those which are close to the times of the Aimmah.
Yeah.
So this is a discussion that he brings up. I'm sorry, I'm going to take a bit of time, but I'm going to it's an important part, so I want to quote him here. So he discusses this, he mentions, then, I mean, you can read the full text whenever you want, whoever wants, we can talk. Then he mentions that this is the famous opinion. This is Akul. Now I'm expressing my opinion. He says, in kana muraduhu, if when you say that amal of mashhur compensates for the weakness of the sanad, if you mean that because mashhur have acted upon it, yujibu al itminanu shakhsi bi sudur al khabar. So let's say there's a faqih. So let's say I'm a faqih. There's a hadith, Maqbul of Umar ibn Hanzala. The sanad is not sahih. So technically it's da'if. But I see that 10 big fuqaha have acted on it. Sheikh Tusi, Sheikh Mufid. And this, their accepting this hadith gives me itminan. It gives me near certainty that this is from the imam. If that's the case, okay? فَالْكُبْرَ وَإِنْ كَانَتْ صَحِيحًا إِذِ الْإِتْمِنَانُ الشَّخْصِ حُجَّةٌ. So it's saying that if someone says that their acting upon this hadith brings personal certainty, I as a faqih, I reach certainty or near certainty that is from the imam, then it's definitely hujjat. I'll accept it. What he doesn't accept is that it, for me, it doesn't bring itminan.
So he's basically saying that if it does bring certainty to someone, it's hujjah. I personally don't think this brings certainty.
Because Sheikh Tusi accepted the narration of Umar ibn Hanzala, I don't read certainties from Imam. But he says, if someone would reach personal itminan and certainty or near certainty, there's no doubt it's hujjah. You can accept it. So what I'm trying to say that...
So just to quickly understand, so why would somebody reach certainty if Sheikh Tusi acted on something? Because we know they might have had access to different resources. Exactly. They were closer to the time of the hudur of the imam and therefore the culture was different.
To that, sometimes for one narration, they would have multiple sanats. And probably the same narration, he had a sahih sanat, but he did not mention it in his book, the sanad where Umar ibn Hanzala was only mentioned. So all these possibilities are there. And so
a person, a faqih, might for himself, what he thinks is that if somebody like Sheikh Tusi and a few others, big
heavyweights
of that time, if they acted on the content of this hadith, it's true the sanad isn't authentic, but their acting on it shows me, and because they were with taqwa, they were very specific about acting on what the imam said. That's what they were after.
Exactly.
So if they acted on it, that they had something that led them to believe it's from the imam.
And what's interesting here in this discussion is that most of the fuqaha accept this, that if you have a da'if narration in terms of sanad, and if you see a good number of those initial fuqaha have acted upon it, they reach itminan. Yes, Ayatullah Khuwi has a difference of opinion here. He says that I don't reach itminan. For me, this action of the mashhur, of the mutakaddimin, the initial generation of fuqaha, it doesn't give me itminan. But he's not saying that if it gives itminan to someone, you cannot use it.
So what he's showing in this, the thing that we get from Sayyid Khoi is that he hasn't limited the authentication to only the Sanadira methodology. What he's saying is that you can use other factors. Well, let's discuss about what the other factors are and whether they can bring that personal conviction or not.
Exactly.
But so he's opened, he's kept the doors open for, let's debate the different other thing. But this itself shows, it shows that the Sanad methodology is not the only one.
Yeah, so, and in fact, and this is good about him, that he himself summarizes. So he discusses it, وَبِلْ جُمْلَ. So bil jumla, let me summarize. He says, لَا بُدَّ فِي حُجِّيَّةِ الْخَبَرِ. So if you want to authenticate a khabar, a hadith, you have two ways. إما الوثوق النوئي بوثاقة الراوي. One way is to look at the rawi and the sanad and say that he's a thika, the regular method. أو الوثوق الشخصي بصدق الخبر ومطابقته للواقع. So one way is you go to the sanad and establish that the sanad is correct. That's one way. The other way is that sanad is one part of the equation. You put together all possible evidence you can have, and if you reach certainty that this is what is mutabik with the reality that Imam said it, of course you would accept it. So I think I wanted to make this clear that even according to Marhum Ayatullah al-Uzma Khui, both these options are open. So authenticating, so I think we've reached a very, very good conclusion.
Yeah. Is this something he had in mind though when he was working on his Rijal? Can we confirm this is his way of dealing with a hadith?
So, because both these ways are open, and one of the ways is to look at the sanad and the Rijal, the people in the sanad. So definitely one of the efforts a faqih needs to take is to understand the Rijal. And therefore he comes, Ayatullah Uzma Khui comes and writes the Mujamul Rijal. So it doesn't negate the idea that, let us say, based on the Rijal and the people in the hadith, I wasn't able to establish a sahih or something. It doesn't close the way for me. I can take the same hadith, get other parts, other types of evidence, and reach itminan about it.
So I guess like Sayyid Khoui went into Rijal, did a huge study and examination of Rijal, and within the Rijal framework came to a certain system of of authenticating certain people, disregarding certain people, that doesn't mean that when he does his fiqh work, he necessarily only uses the sanad.
Yeah, so this is the thing.
All these efforts in Rijal, for example, I mentioned earlier that we have some scholars who have filtered through books like Al-Kafi or Bihar and then brought it down to very few volumes of Sahih Hadith. Their efforts was just to say sahih that from the Rijali perspective, these are the Sahih. But that doesn't mean this is the only useful amount of Al-Kafi.
Exactly.
Right? In fact, because there are other Ahadith that through other ways we can authenticate them. So their effort is an academic effort, which is very valuable from a Rijali perspective, which is great. Yeah. But the Rijal discussion is not exclusive, and this is not the only thing we need to look at.
Exactly. So here we come to so many other ways of authenticating hadith. Again, our time is less, so I'll just very quickly point to what are the other. Now, let's say based on sanad, they couldn't establish the authenticity, and I take this hadith, and now I want to put all my effort and put all the evidence together to see if this was actually from the imam or not. So how does it work? There are many, many different ways to do it. So one of the standard ways is to see if the same hadith has appeared in other places with different chains. Mm. So this idea of tawatur, this idea of one single hadith being narrated with different independent chains of narrations. How does that help me? And let us say all of those chains, so let's say there's one hadith narrated by four chains, independent ones, and all the four chains in terms of their sanad are da'if, means you couldn't establish that it's sahih. Like there was probably one person in every single chain about whom we don't know if it was reliable or not. Okay. Does that mean that we just disregard this hadith? No. Hear what you say, that look, when one single thing is narrated by four independent chains of narration, the probability of all four chains lying or making a mistake drastically reduces. So here, it's interesting if you really want to feel how it works, to bring in a bit of probability here. So you might think that, why am I doing this? Has anyone done this? Yes. So for example, Shahid Sad in his books, he brings this probability calculation. So let me even do it very briefly here. So let's say that the first chain of narration, number one, the probability of error in it is that maybe if you just look at this narration, there's one person whose authenticity is not established. Let's say the probability of error in it is, let's say, 1/3. It's possible, right? Like there's 1/3, there's 33% probability that either a mistake happened or Imam didn't say it and this chain came to be formed. 1/3. And imagine that the other chains also have a similar probability of error. So first one, 1/3. Second one, 1/3. Third one, 1/3. Fourth one, 1/3. Based on probability calculation, the probability that all four chains have lied or made a mistake would be a product of these probabilities. So you say 1/3 times 1/3 times 1/3 times 1/3. It becomes 9 times 9, which is 1/81. Okay, so that's from 33% probability of error in one chain, if you have four chains, the probability goes down to 1% that all of four of them would have lied. Okay, so if you just had this one chain and you didn't have tawatur and multiple independent sets of narrations, you'd say that there's a 33% probability that this is false. And of course, 33% error is big, right? It's not called itminan. It's not certainty when you're only 67% sure about something. But if you have four chains of narrations, the probability, the percentage of error goes down to 1%. You become 99%. And it's even logical, right? That one person comes and tells you a certain news, that there's an earthquake in a certain place. You don't see that earthquake. I don't know this person. Four people who are not related to each other. We have to put the exact conditions. Four different people not connected to each other, they come and they tell you the same news. You immediately, with three and four people, you reach itminan, that these people are not connected to each other. Then how comes all of them are lying at the same time about one single thing? So I'm just giving an example that one of the ways to reach certainty about a narration that Imam said this is this idea of multiple narrations.
Yeah.
So they talk about this, and there are so many other factors. I'll just list them because we don't have time to go into the details. So for example, they said that, so this is their Shahid Sadr in the Al-Halakatul Thalitha, he talks about. So for example, he says that if these narrators in different chains, if they are from different cities and from different schools of thought, you reach certainty faster. Why? Because when two people from different cities tell you one thing, the probability that they would have colluded together to lie to you decreases.
So we're talking about a time when there was no social media.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, someone in Basra narrates something to you, someone from Medina comes and narrates to you, they have no connection to each other. Probably even with two people telling, you'll reach certainty that, even though if you wouldn't know that they're thicker or not. So these factors...
Can I just remind the brothers and sisters again that, look, when we're saying all of this, these are not universal without exception. Sometimes we could have, let's say, four chains, okay, that... As you said, the probability of these being lies is very less.
Yeah.
But then we have another very strong proof that these are not authentic. For example, they contradict the aql very clearly.
So for example,
a clear contradiction with the aql.
So I think this is one part of the puzzle.
So this is where we say that, look, yes, it's true that on a general basis, we can follow this rule. Yeah. But there are exceptions. And these sort of putting all of these together help us find out where the exception is. So in this case, for example, we can find through the intellect that a certain set of hadith is wrong. True that in terms of their sanad, they're da'if. But adding this aql, in terms of the sanad, they're sahih. But adding the aql factor here, we can see there's a clear contradiction.
Yeah.
The imam would never have said such a thing.
You have to be absolutely sure.
Yeah, you have to be absolutely sure. Yeah. So you need to, again, the intellect, when we say the khat, the intellect.
So everything has to be in its place. So I think this gives us a very, at least a holistic and good understanding of what happens when it comes to authenticating hadith. I'll just quote... Marhum Wahid Behbehani, so he's one of the famous usulis, long time back. So he, while discussing this, he says that the same thing we're talking about, that sanad is not the only way to authentic hadith. There are other ways, and there are other pieces of evidence that you can put together and reach certainty about. Then he lists them. So I'll just read the list for you. We're not going into the details, except for the last one. Last one is rather interesting.
Okay.
And we'll finish there, I think. So he says, for example, he says, the fatwa of mashhur ulama. This could be a possible thing that...
All these need to be discussed, obviously.
Discussed. I'm not saying that. But he's saying that at least give this a chance. Bring this into the equation. You have a hadith, and there are 10 fuqaha who have given fatwa exactly accordance to what this hadith is saying. Something. It's a factor to consider, he says. And he gives example of Maqbul of Umar ibn Hanzala. That's the standard example we have. Then he brings another. He says that a strong agreement with the established principles of Quran and intellect. So in the same manner, you're giving the example that if you have something that contradicts the intellect, that somehow that would take away its authenticity.
Yeah.
You can do it the other way around. You have a hadith and you see that this hadith is completely in line with those established principles. It's some indication.
Yeah, some indication.
I'm not saying it's a conclusive. Yeah. It's a part of indication. So he says this could be. But at least we can discuss this. Then the third thing that he brings, and this is an interesting discussion. We go into the details. But we need to look at it. He says that sometimes the content can be an indication that it's from the imam. Okay, you might say, what do you mean? Okay, let me give you a very clear example. And this, the scholars have said, you pick up this magnificent book called Sahifa Sajadiyya. Okay, it's a book of dua, but in a technical sense, it's hadith, right? It's in a technical sense, it's
the words of
Imam Sajjad Okay, it's attributed to him. Now, there's sanadi discussion you can have about Sahifa Sajjadiyya. What are the chains of transmission? Who are the rijal in there? And the discussion is there that you have two chains of narrations. So, one is that Imam Sajjad wrote the entire Sahifa with his own hands. he put it in a sanduq and gave it to two different copies, one to his son Zayd, a shaheed, and Imam Baqir. So you have these two chains of... So one approach is the sanadi approach. Sahifa Sajjadiyya, look at the chain and who are the people and that. But some of the scholars have said that you don't need to actually. Why? Because you look at the content and the quality of the material there, how Imam Sajjad is doing munajat, that you cannot find anything even close to that from other than the imams. Mm.
You can level, see the ma'rifah of Allah coming out of those words. Yeah,
and really, I don't know. I'm sure those of you know Arabic and who read it, they can feel it. It's something that it shakes you from your core. Like the way he's speaking, the level of the ma'arif that are there, and even the eloquence of the thing. So this is a slightly different approach where you're saying that this content is so unique, so special in so many different ways that it cannot have been from other than the imam. So this is one piece of evidence. You also have some sanad. You also have this idea amongst the ulama that this is authentic. You put all of this together, you reach certainty that it has to be from the imam. So the same. So I'll even give you that scholars have said this. So we have one of the scholars, Sheikh Mohsin Al-Amin. So this was his thing, that Sahifa doesn't need a sanad to prove its authenticity. Mm-hmm. The content is shouting that, look, I'm from a special person, from the imam. I'll give you another example, and that's of Nahjul Balagha. Mm-hmm. So Ibn Abil Hadid, who is a Mu'tazali Sunni scholar, who wrote that commentary of Nahjul Balagha, so a Sunni scholar, so impressed by it that he wrote a full commentary, he says that, look, Nahjul Balagha doesn't need a sanad. Why? The content is the best proof, the eloquence that's there. And believe me, Nahjul Balagha is a masterpiece of Arabic. And those who know, they know. Yes. It's called Nahjul Balagha. It's a peak of eloquence. And everyone attests to that, that he uses in one of his essays, that ke, فَوْكَ كَلَامِ الْمَخْلُوكَ دُونَ كَلَامِ الْخَالِقِ. So he describes, he says that it's above what people can write. فَوْكَ كَلَامِ الْمَخْلُوكَ. Of course, it's lower than the Quran. دُونَ كَلَامِ الْخَالِقِ. So I'm saying that all these ways are there, and each of these is a piece of evidence that you can put together, and you can authenticate a lot of the narrations that we have, that in that technical other sense would be even called da'if, which according to the sanad are not correct. And I think this is a very, very, very important point. Yeah. And you'll see this happening in the discussion imam as well. So the narration that would be brought, they will be authenticated using all possible tools, sometimes sanad, sometimes other things, sometimes tawathur. So example, the same idea of ilmul ghaib. So let's say you have 10 narrations that talk about this idea that imams had some ilmul ghaib. Forget the details. This core meaning that imams had
some amount of
ilmul ghaib is common in these 10 narrations with 10 different chains. You read certainty that there is, they call it tawatur ma'nawi. So the words of the narrations are different, but each of these narrations, they have a common meaning.
They have a common, they indicate to the a common
Common
thing,
meaning,
yeah.
That common meaning becomes certain. You can attribute it to the imam, say the imam intended this meaning.
Yeah.
So I really, really hope that this discussion will solve a lot of, should solve a lot of fundamental issues. And we need, and it will bring back that importance of hadith.
So
in our Islamic understanding.
So I'm just thinking that someone might be feeling that how could a hadith that has a za'if person be authentic? And basically because we keep, we're storing grain in our mind that look, if somebody is za'if, that means they've lied. No, every da'if person doesn't lie.
It's a terminology. It's a word that's stuck there.
Every da'if person, in fact, every liar doesn't always lie.
Even that's the thing. So even if a liar narrates a narration, you can't just right there say that this specific thing here, even he has lied. Maybe you'll say 90% there's a probability that he's lied here.
Yeah.
But you can't in every single instance say that he's a constant, habitual absolute liar who lies every single instance.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
Yeah. So just to wrap up this discussion, I want to mention this really beautiful thing one of my teachers had said about hadith, and I think it sort of sums up everything we've said over here. And what he said was this, that look, every hadith comes with two things on us. One is a duty and one is a right. When we see a hadith, we have the duty to check if it is authentic or not. It gives us the duty to go and check, because if it is from the imam, it's very valuable. Yeah. So it gives us that duty. On the other hand, it has a right on us that we should not just discard it just because for whatever reason. It has a right that, look, we should consider it and we should give it a chance and weigh it out. So you have the duty to check, and you don't have the right to just throw it away.
Yeah,
right?
Don't accept
every hadith, but don't just reject it either.
Yeah.
Put in the effort, go and check it. And if you can't go and check it, other people are doing the work, they're checking it. And checking doesn't just mean looking, like you said, you know, go on the software, find, okay, sahih, da'if, oh, this hadith is gone out.
Oh, this guy doesn't have a tawfiq, so you are done, and just discard this. No, it doesn't work like that. Yeah. Much more precision and care needs to be put in, definitely.
Okay. So I think that's it for today.
I'm happy to say this, that alhamdulillah, we have discussed those very, very important and key foundational and fundamental and methodological issues that go into, for example, the discussion on imamah that we're going to have. And I'm sure, like, it's like we're ready with all our gear and we're ready to dive now into and get those very beautiful pearls of imamah, which will only reach us if we dive deep into this knowledge. They're not on the surface. You need to spend time.
Yeah.
And it was mentioned that this is a very long course, but in reality, given the importance of this idea of imamah and the impact it has on our practical lives and on our salvation, these 20 hours is nothing. It's insignificant. Much, yeah. And I can guarantee you that it's worth the effort.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
worth the effort. And it's a pursuit that we all need to go after. It's really important, I think.
Definitely. So thank you very much, Sheikhna. It was a really interesting discussion. So I think, as you said, we have taken most of those foundations, and we've equipped ourselves, geared ourselves for now diving into the topic of imamah itself. And though I do have some questions in mind regarding certain foundations, but having a general understanding of where we're going in the discussion with the other different scholars as well, there will be opportunities to ask those in those sessions as well.
Some of those,
so the doors are not completely closed yet.
Definitely.
So the doors for these discussions are not completely closed. There is still some room over there. Obviously, as a focus, these three sessions were the main focus of the discussion. So thank you very much, Sheikhna. I hope the brothers and sisters benefited, and inshallah, we'll see you one more time, but this time with a different perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
Into imamah. We're diving into imamah and looking into the aqli, the intellectual arguments for imamah, and what the aql can tell us about imamah. So until the next session, inshallah, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.